Like to welcome you and start the meeting. We're going to go through a roll call, and I'm on my laptop, so I'm going to switch back and forth between screens. But I'd ask you just to say here if you're here, and I see the Chief Justice has joined us, so I'll start with her. Maureen O'Connor?
Here.
Nick Savaggio's here. Laura Baker Morish?
Here.
Kristen Boggs, Paula Brown, Brooke Burns,
here.
Beth Capelli,
here.
Annette Chambers Smith, Charles Chandler.
Brian Spoon here for Charles Chandler.
Thank you. Robert DeLamater.
Here.
John Eklund. Robert Fregali.
Here.
Sean Gallagher.
Here.
Gwen Howe Giebers.
Here.
Ryan Geese.
Here.
Kathleen Hamm.
Here.
Terry Jameson. Jennifer McElfrish.
Here.
Chip McConville. Steve McIntosh. Kevin Miller. Aaron Montz.
Present.
David Painter. Liz Paprocki. Bill Seitz. Larry Sims.
Here.
Ken Spanigle.
Here.
Brandon Stanley.
Here.
Cecil Thomas. Tyrone Yates.
Here.
And Tim Young.
Here.
All right. It's my belief that our House of Representatives and state senators are most likely in legislative meetings. And so that would.
Yeah. Judge Savaggio, I did confirm with their offices that that is indeed the case.
Okay. Great. So you've had a copy of the minutes sent out to you. Are there any deletions, corrections, anything you'd like to talk about? If not, can I have a motion to adopt?
Motion to adopt, Spanigle.
Is there a second?
Second, Fregali.
All right. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye or wave.
Aye.
Aye.
Beautiful. Sounds like a Christmas choir. All those opposed? All right. Sarah, I'm looking for my agenda and I can't find it. So would you take the reins?
Sure. So thanks everyone for joining us. Our first item for discussion is an update on our project with the sentencing data platform. I think you'll be pleased with the amount of progress we've made since our last meeting. As you know, Judge Zamuda chaired our ad hoc committee to create the uniform sentencing entry and the method of conviction entries and other companion documents. And he has been willing to continue his work on our project. And so he's going to update us on the platform.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all. So this is the holiday season, and as I was preparing for today's presentation, I was thinking about Christmas movies. And in thinking about Christmas movies and Christmas presents, I was thinking about when I was a little kid getting an Erector set that had to be assembled. And I was all excited about it until I realized how lengthy the directions were in assembling that Erector set. My enthusiasm dimmed quickly because of all the steps that had to be taken. And I think as I try to put my, sort of a perspective of where we are as it relates to the creation of this felony sentencing data platform, assembly is not only required, and we're in the assembly stage, and I'll get to the specifics in a moment, but we're doing something extraordinary in the assembly of that platform. We're doing it without direction. We're creating the direction for how to create these platforms going forward. And it's really remarkable what we've achieved thus far and where we're headed and what we're likely to be at come spring of next year, the next time we meet. So we had our kickoff at the end of September. And what we've done in terms of the creation of this data platform is create certain teams or groups of individuals to help divide the work necessary for how we envision the creation of this accessible, web searchable platform for felony sentence information. And those teams consist primarily of, the first level of team is, I think, the most important, which is that we call it the implementation team. And these consist of information technology SMEs. SMEs, of course, Judge Savaggio, as you know, is a subject matter expert. And these are the subject matter experts on our side, the commission side, and they are assembled here today. We have Todd Ives and Nikki Hotchkiss and Scott Shoemaker, who for the record does not like being called a SME because it reminds him of a Disney cartoon, he told me. But also, we have representatives of information technology people from University of Cincinnati who we have engaged in the creation of the technology backbone, the architecture that will be implemented as we move forward with this. And one of the things that we did early on, and this is I think, credit to Sarah and how this is working. I've been involved previously in other attempts to adopt criminal or court practices using current technology. And the technology people are technology whizzes, but they have zero to no or very little knowledge about how we do our job within the court setting. And oftentimes the reverse is also true. While we may know our court setting and court process, we don't really have a real good handle on the IT, the information technology. So what we did is after we did the kickoff, we sat down and we answered their questions, and we literally did a tutorial about the court process. So they understood the process of how cases progress to their conclusion, so that as they envision how to create this web-based data port, that they would understand the import of that sentencing entry and how it gets to be a sentencing entry. Just as important, we, the criminal justice people, sat through a tutorial with them to understand what they're doing. And they used this cell phone, and they said, look, this cell phone is modern technology. We're not creating a cell phone by doing the platform. What we're doing is when you open up your cell phone, you have various apps. One of those apps will be this platform. We're creating the ability to access information that will be downloaded or uploaded to a particular platform, all right, that will consist initially of felony sentence information. And I think it's important to help frame where we, at the beginning of this project, what each side input is so that we each understand in going forward. And I think it's led to far more honest and informed decision-making as the implementation has moved forward. Second group is called a coordination team. And really it's just, it's Sarah, myself, and Hazem, who is the representative from UC. And we coordinate the work of the other groups just to make sure that we're not missing anything, that if the information that's been generated results in other information that needs to be conducted or whatever, we help manage the process there. Second most important group is the next group, which is the project team. And this is a critical group of stakeholders consisting of judges and clerks and other practitioners who provide the necessary direction and answering as the implementation team will create that framework, presents it to the project team, and as practitioners say, well, you know, this is really how it's being done in courts, such that we don't have that disconnect between a technological fix, but an impractical fix that really wouldn't be useful to the benefit of the practitioners, which are the court, members of the public, and the like. And what happens then with the project team, and the last is the governance board team, which is a statewide group of criminal justice members, acting, quite frankly, as a board of directors to oversee policies that are being recommended from the project team below, and to make those reports to the commission, this commission above. It's critical for the role of the governance board is critical for long-range planning, integration with other Ohio data collection operations, and for funding issues that will need to be implemented. So next group that has been created, and this is one of my favorites actually, I call it the College of Judges. It's an assembly of individual judges who, for whatever reason, have heard about, were involved in, because they served on the ad hoc committee, so they were involved in the creation of the use document and the method of conviction documents. They've heard about it and they say, you know what, this sounds like something I would like to adopt in my court. How can I need more information. And then when we talk about the data piece and the import and relevance of that data piece in being able to provide information for the first time in the criminal justice setting to explain how well we do things and maybe where we don't do things as well as we would like, but how we can improve doing things. In other words, that data piece. And they're saying, I'm in, how can I help? And what we've done is, the College of Judges, it actually starts with the chief, because when after she created the ad hoc committee and after we created the use and made the recommendations to her, she said, look, we're not going to do what has happened in the past, which is attempt a statewide wholesale mandated adoption of the use, but rather recognized that it should be growing organically. It should grow from practitioners up, by the judges up saying, yes, this is something we should use. And we do that for two reasons. Number one, to make sure that we got it right on the use, that entry is comprehensively all of the current law necessary for implementation of felony sentence in Ohio. And secondly, that we can take the steps to create a data platform and use those data elements contained within our use document or our MOC document to extract that data. The College of Cardinals are judges who are cross-section of Ohio. So they're from all quadrants, various types of courts, to help sell to each other, in other words, our fellow judges, to help sell within the community the import of this project. Their role has been crucial and will continue to be crucial going forward. So that's what we did in the first month of October when we began. November, we saw two things. The commission applied for, and I'm happy to report, received a grant. The grant was from the Ohio Department of Public Safety, Office of Criminal Justice Services. So we received a substantial grant of $60,000 plus that will pay for this project. So we now had the funding necessary to complete this initial project phase. And I think we should recognize Sarah for her effort in creating that application and seeing to its success. And I think we should recommend that. The other thing we've done is Sarah and I have met with the Ohio State University in a different capacity because one of the things that I've been concerned about is as we vet the process of data collection, who has access to it, what's the data that's being accessed, those sort of questions. There are, I think, ethical issues that need to be vetted or concerned or evaluated. And so what Sarah and I have approached a couple of professors at the Ohio State University, one of whom is on the phone with us, and that's Professor Berman, Doug, as well as his counterpart, which is Professor Hirsch. And we are in the process of creating an additional project for their use because of their expertise, which is going to be captioned Aligning Algorithmic Risk Assessments with Criminal Justice Values. We'll have more detail about that project and its impact in this particular project next spring at our next meeting, but I think it is appropriate to recognize the magnitude of what we're doing here which is why I recognize at this time. Because of this organically growing of the project amongst various courts within Ohio, that continues to grow. Kudos to the chief who's presented to the winner Common Pleas Judges Association, and most importantly, new judges training. We have had a substantial number of new trial court felony judges who were elected this past November. A number of them have reached out to Sarah and the commission and saying, look, I heard a presentation about this data entry. I'm interested, please, how do I use that? What do I need? That's how we're growing the effort of this project organically. And that means we're continuing to strive to educate and to utilize the resources of this great commission in order to accomplish that. So successful are we that we, as you know, we created a pilot court. Judge Jeff Reed from Allen County has agreed to serve as the initial pilot court to demonstrate whether or not the concept that we have can be achieved practically within that court. It's a test case. We acknowledge that. We start with one court and with its success, migrate to all 88 county courts that handle felony sentencing in Ohio. What's interesting is because of this organically growing system that's happening, we've now been approached, and it's public information, so I'm not ashamed to acknowledge this, that the largest common pleas felony court in Ohio happens to be in Cuyahoga County. There's 34 of them. The judges of Cuyahoga County asked Sarah and I to present because they're interested in trying to understand how they can adopt this use document for data collection purposes in that court and moving forward on that. And I think that's significant, the groundswell of support within the bench itself and recognizing the importance of this project. And stay tuned, we'll see how those are developing. So as we're moving forward with the implementation of the platform itself through the various committees that I also identified, the other thing that we recognize is we're dealing with data. Our use document, the template, that sentencing information that we created, right, which is a living document. So we have created committees that will make sure that that's always correct in the current iteration of the law. So we update the use form as law changes, as the Supreme Court issues a decision that could impact the language within the sentencing entry. We have a committee that will update and correct to conform to existing law what that sentencing entry, so that every judge who uses this document will always have the confidence to know that it's the current version of the law and that people like Sean Gallagher and Gene Zimuda won't overturn them when their cases are appealed because of using incorrect sentencing entries. All right?
Judge Zimuda, let me interrupt right there to say that we just sent that update to the user group, so to speak. So if anybody on the call today or in the commission would like to see how that looks and kind of the updates that we made since the report was released in August, just let me know and I'll send it to you.
All right, great, excellent, thank you. So that's one set of data, because each one of the elements contained within that use sentencing is a data point, okay, from which when we finish the platform, will serve to feel the data information that will become searchable. There's a second category of data, and that's data about cases that aren't relevant because they're not pertinent to the sentencing entry. A lot of the background information, for example, the gender, the race, the name, of the individual defendants, that's already known and established. It's not part of the sentencing entry. There is a wealth of data that exists in other areas within Ohio, others, what I call silos of information. The prosecutor's offices, for example, have a substantial amount of data. Probation departments have a substantial amount of data about individuals. And so the second category of what we're working toward is the interfacing with those existing data portals, as I call it. Because we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need access to other people's wheels so that we can elicit the data that we believe is relevant and necessary to have the most vibrant and robust data platform for felony sentence. And that's the goal. And if someone other, another source of data exists, we don't need to create it ourselves. We just need to access it. And so trying to find those other sources and then coordinating with those other sources to access it is the second category of data that we're looking at. The third, which we hope is going to be the smallest and is the most unknown presently, are those data points for which there is no current data field, either because it's not within the purview of the use document or it doesn't exist in an existing data platform elsewhere. But it's data that we collectively will say is relevant, necessary, and of import for the data platform to be as vibrant as we expect it and want it to be. We haven't identified any data elements as to that category yet, and I hope it's zero. But I'll be honest, it could be something, and if so, we'll need to figure out where we can find that or how we create that data to make sure that we can maintain our commitment to having the most vibrant data platform possible. So that's where we're headed. There's a lot of work that I've just described. Hopefully I didn't take more time, Sarah, than I was allotted, but I thought it was important to explain how much we've done, we can continue to do, and here's the really important thing as I close, and happy to answer any questions that you might have. By our next meeting of this commission, we should have made substantial progress. I know that because we just had our first site visit between our technology people at UC and the court in Allen County. And I love those meetings because that's where the rubber meets the road. It's one thing to talk the theory of sentence, to talk the theory of the technology of data and how we elicit that. But it's always interesting to see when the tech people that are creating the system watch what happens in court. So many people who want the data never have been in court to see the reality of how we do what we do in our court system, right? And I'm happy to report that was, I think, a really successful interface. So much so that we're pretty excited about where we're headed, such that by the next time this commission meets, which I believe is in March, Sarah, is that correct? That yeah. We should be well on our way to having developed this platform and be able to explain in pretty significant detail, I think, or I hope, where we're likely to have success and where the pitfalls may lie, so that policy decisions may be coming to this commission for consideration at that point. So that's where we are. I'm excited. I think this is great work. I appreciate Sarah's ask. As you can tell by my enthusiasm, it's really significant to be able to, I think, create a system that will help each of us do a better job in dispensing of justice. And that's really what we do, right? When we impose a sentence, we want it to be the right sentence. And what the right sentence is a fair sentence. So, and I think this platform will be a significant tool in achieving that end. I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any. And Sarah, I'll look to you to make sure I didn't miss. I don't think I missed anything, but. Any questions?
Questions for Gene or Judge Zamuda. I do have a comment. And my comment is prefaced by the fact that my circumstances as to where I practice law, I think dictate certainly my perspective. So I'm the only judge on the Common Pleas bench in Champaign County. And I understand, and one, I would congratulate the commission and Judge Zamuda and the number of folks that have worked to put this sentencing entry together. And I really, and I applaud and understand the goal of what we're trying to do. I get all that. But I do want to express what I think is a long-term concern as to how judges are going to use this document. And that concern is this, and it's actually predicated upon my prior experience as the county prosecutor. And when I took office as a county prosecutor in the mid-90s, I used to, you know, we had grand jury once a month, and I used to take my criminal files home over the course of the weekend and the week preceding grand jury, and I would hand write out the indictments. And then I'd give them to my staff, and they would type up the indictments, and we'd go forward. And so for 15 of the 16 years as prosecutor, I read my report, I looked at the case, the statute book, and hand copied the law onto a piece of notebook paper, and then gave it to my staff, and they typed it up. And then in year 16, we had the matrix system, which many of you may be familiar with, but the gist of it is that the prosecutor can now go to a computer program, click some buttons, and it reproduces the charge that has already been researched and has already been verified and validated as the appropriate language. And it's now it's computer generated. And what I have noticed is that with the newest prosecutors coming in, they don't, and I'm not looking to generalize, but just in my experience here, they overlook some important elements in the offenses because the manner in which this is being exposed to them is computer generated as opposed to generated through self-study. And when I took the bench, I developed my own forms and I developed my own sentencing entries. And I get chided by my staff and by other attorneys and of course my friends on the bench as to the length of my entries. And I appreciate that. And I actually love the ability to debate. But one of the things I've noticed about my entries is that in every single entry I have, not only do I make reference to the purposes and principles, but I actually write those out. You know, those are written out on the document. And I also write out the reasons why I put somebody on community control or put them or send them to prison. And again, it's driven by the fact that I, in a smaller jurisdiction, can do that. But I think it provides two important lessons. Number one, it forces the judge to look at those purposes and principles of sentencing each and every time. Am I protecting the public, punishing the offender, and rehabilitating the offender? And is what I am doing placing an unnecessary burden on state or local resources? And I think that about that every time I make a decision, and I have a worksheet that I'm not embarrassed to say is 40 pages long that I go through every sentencing and I click boxes and I do all that kind of stuff, but I think about it every single time. And I write out findings every single time. Now, I understand that in the big jurisdictions, you don't have the time to do that. And I appreciate that. But my concern is that we will have success with this sentencing entry because I have faith in the people that are doing this work. And I have faith in the reason why we're doing this work. We want to see broad scale how judges in different jurisdictions are applying the law. And I think that's important. But I do fear that once we go to a system where all a judge has to do is start checking boxes, and maybe in a lot of jurisdictions, that's certainly the case now. that new judges lose that perspective as to why we're doing this and why was it created like this. And I think I think now it's going to work out fine. But I think 10 years from now, it's really going to be incumbent upon the judiciary, whether it be through training or through our defense bar, through appellate practice, to really force judges to look at why they're constructing their entries the way they're constructing it. With that, that's my comment.
May I respond? Because I understand that fear, and it's the difference between whether this is going to be a crutch or a tool. And the way we have it designed, it's a tool. It has to be utilized by the court proactively as opposed to passively, because it's a living document. It isn't, that's what's amazing about this. It's not a static document that you just check a box and then pass it on to the next person. There's thought and direction based on the current status of the law. One of the outcomes of this site visit, for example, Judge Reed does like you, Judge Savaggio. He likes articulating on the record the factors that he finds appropriate or relevant for the imposition, whatever the sentence is that he's imposing. You know, the law doesn't require those findings to be put in the record. They're there for your consideration, but they don't have to be articulated. The law doesn't obligate that. But the way we have this designed is we have the minimum as required by law, but we also have what's called good civics. And I know Sean, I think Sean Gallagher is still here. That was his idea, to have good civics, right? Because that's a better practice than what the minimum standard necessary for the law is required in terms of these entries. And we're encouraging, based on what Judge Reed asked us to do, is to create another modification of the use to incentivize the factors. As an appellate judge now, I see more and more sentences that I'm reviewing where the trial court judges are in fact articulating those factors that they found relevant. All right. I think that's important, because it's crucial for you as a trial judge to articulate why is it that a sentence is what a sentence is, right? So, and I think that to me, that illustrates how this will be a tool, not the crutch by which there's no thought in the process. The other thing is, it's iterated in such a way that you can't make a mistake if you use the document, because you can't impose an incorrect sentence. You can't impose a sentence inconsistent with the parameters or whatever the statute is that's relevant. That's the vibrancy of this living document, or the template of the use, to help eliminate those types of errors as well, which happens when it becomes a crutch, not a tool.
But for the, and I appreciate that, but for the offender that receives this, the journal entry, and for the family members of that offender that want to appeal that entry and take it to a lawyer, does our entry, and maybe it does, but I would, does our entry instill confidence in the decision that was reached? And all I'm saying is that I'm not as concerned about today as I am concerned with my successor down the road, who will have grown up through this computer system. And as judges, I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that this entry will not be taken for granted. And I'm not sure really how you do that, other than through training and emphasis, but there have to be certain practice points where we have to recognize that we're trading data accumulation for that intangible that I have to be worried about when I issue that sentencing entry. Then we really take a step back. I mean, we take a step front, but we also take a step back. And all I want to say, you know, all I'm trying to get across is we need to make sure that we keep that principle in mind. Otherwise, our work in 10 years is really going to be more challenging.
Well, let's see how well we do between now and next year to see how well we can achieve the goal to worry about that 10-year mark. I understand that. So, you know, we've already started, as you I think know, in new judges training, where we're educating, and that's a key to change the mindset of judges about this is a tool for your help. This isn't something that we're afraid of. We should not be afraid to be able to understand what it is that we're doing when we impose sentences. Does it really make sense intuitively on certainly on an individual basis it may, but collectively, are there resources available? Is there information that exists when you start studying the sentencing practices of courts, all right, that we can utilize to improve court operation? That to me is significant. And that's what this in part can achieve as well. So cautionary indeed, but I think it's something that we're mindful of and we'll address as we develop this.
As always, I appreciate being able to ride the seesaw with you, Gene. Okay.
Judge Sabagio, can I add one thing to what Judge Muda said? Having worked with the committee as well, I mean, we gathered sentencing entries from multiple courts, including your own, as well as that you know. And while your entry may have been sort of the Cadillac of entries that we had an opportunity to take a look at, there were a lot of Volkswagens out there. Yeah. Not to disparage Volkswagens, but sentencing entries that had just minimal information. And so I think this entry, if nothing else, is going to improve the quality of the number of entries that are going to be used around the state as well. And to Judge Zamuda's point, I think hopefully decreasing the number of mistakes that go up on appeal because of the fact that the sentencing entries are incorrect or it's difficult to understand exactly what the sentence that was imposed by the court. So while the concerns that you have raised, I think, are legitimate, I think overall there's going to be improvement as more and more judges begin using the uniform entry. You may not get to where you're at, but I think it will improve considerably.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Steve. Thank you. Other comments or questions for Gene? Okay, Sarah, next.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Judge Zamuda. And thank you, everybody that is on the commission, and especially the chief and Judge Zamuda for supporting the effort. It's going to be a long slog, but we're in it. So thank you. Next on the agenda is Scott Shoemaker is going to give us an update and legislative review. As you know, the legislature is going to have a long day today. We had hoped that we would have more clarity than we do when we had the meeting on the calendar, but Scott has done a nice job of trying to wrap up some important legislative efforts, and I'll turn it over to him at this point.
Thanks, Sarah. Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to kind of go through the sort of hot button or the things that we know are moving here at the in lame duck, as well as some items that we expect to be picked up again next year. Just briefly talk about those, what impact they might have for the commission, and then open these up to discussion for what people think projects moving forward for the commission might be. So really hoping it to be more of a discussion. So if anybody wants to say something, don't hesitate to, raise your hand, interrupt me, or put a question in chat or something like that if you have a question about one of these bills specifically. Obviously, the biggest one that's been talked about in this GA is probably Senate Bill 3. That's the bill dealing with the reforms to the drug sentencing statutes. It was passed in the Senate back in June, and then a substitute version was introduced in the House committee last week on the 9th. It was voted out of committee with amendments on the 16th, so yesterday. It is not currently on the agenda for a House floor vote today, which was kind of a surprise to a lot of people. They worked really hard to get that out of committee. It did pass out of committee 7-3. It was not unanimous, but that bill is not currently on the agenda for a House floor vote today. It would also need a concurrence from the Senate, given that a sub bill was accepted in the House. Should that bill pass, it's going to, it still contains the unclassified misdemeanor low level possession offenses, makes a lot of changes around the trafficking laws, but it does keep the high level trafficking F3 and above at the current drug amounts that are under current law. Does make some changes around the penalties though. And it also includes the shackling of or restraint of women or children during and after pregnancy bill that was previously Senate Bill 18 that was amended into the bill at one point as well. One thing that we did work with the OJC, and a big thanks to Marta, who's not here this morning, for her work on this, and it was something we learned after Reagan-Tokes. Judge Salvaggio actually suggested that should the bill pass, it won't go into effect, at least as currently written, it wouldn't go into effect until July 1st of next year. And that would give time for the OJC, the Judicial College, the commission to work to educate practitioners on the changes that are in the bill, give people time to change the case management systems, accommodate this new unclassified misdemeanor to the extent that needs to be done, educate the judiciary at the summer conference and things like that. So that is one change we were able to get incorporated in there that we were pretty happy Marta was able to help us with. The bill also contains a couple different items related specifically to the commission. One being designating the commission as a criminal justice agency, which is something we've been looking for a while in a bill. It's going to help with our modernization, and it allows us access to some criminal justice information databases a little bit more easily. It also asks that the commission study the impact of the bill and report biennially. Todd and Nikki, I know you guys have been thinking about ways in which we might be able to study the impact of the bill if it passes, if there's anything you guys wanted to talk about or any ideas that you had.
Yeah, we can take questions if anyone has anything specific on that. But if Senate Bill 3 passes, we first looked to some other states, namely California, Oklahoma, and a few others that have passed similar to Senate Bill 3, either citizen petitions or their General Assembly bills. But mainly we're looking at what's the impact on the state prison system, how do the admissions and length of stay there change? We're also looking at fiscal impacts, studying the cost of incarceration, the cost of treatment, with special consideration of not just how does it impact the budget of the state, but also what costs are borne by local governments and also individuals. The biggest data source for that would be the numbers that DRC would be able to provide, but we've also talked about partnering with local counties to get a more in-depth look at what they're experiencing. And as always, in Ohio, data is a little bit of an issue because we don't have, at the county level, we don't have great aggregated state data. So it would require partnerships with a lot of people to study these questions.
Again, if people have questions or comments, feel free to weigh in. Some more work that we would consider moving forward. Obviously, we do have that drug sentencing quick reference guide for practitioners that the commission updates and hosts on our website. That would be updated to change, to reflect the changes that would come out of SB3. I'd also plan on doing a written primer, just sort of a brief breakdown of what's in the bill, similar to the legislative analysis that might come out, but kind of aimed more for practitioners to easily reference. But that's what we know so far about Senate Bill 3. Again, it's going to be a crazy day, I think, seeing what exactly does happen over at the legislature. But there was a lot of work that specifically Rep. Seitz, who is a commission member, and obviously they're busy today and he couldn't be here, but Rep. Seitz did put a lot of work in trying to get the bill to a place where he knew everybody wasn't going to be happy with it, but to get the bill to the place where he get it out of committee and get it up to a floor vote. So I imagine he's working pretty hard to get that put back on the agenda for today. If people have questions, go ahead and let me know now.
This All is right. Beth Capelli. Can I ask one question as far as gathering data in the future? And right now, this may not be very accurate, simply because I know as a municipal court judge, I think twice about who I'm putting in the local jails right now. But I think that cooperation with the local jails to see how that impacts the local jails and how many felonies are in those locations versus misdemeanors will be very important, because otherwise you're just shifting the burden.
One of the things that was brought, there were a couple amendments that were in the bill there at the end, which dealt with different aspects of kind of what you're talking about, Judge. And one of which was ensuring how an order to CBCF or a halfway house would get paid for. But the other, I think, specific to your concern was there is a provision in the bill that these unclassified misdemeanors could serve their sentence in a prison facility if the local jail was at 90% capacity or above. So if the sheriff says, hey, we're too full to take these people, that unclassified misdemeanor in that situation could go to a prison. I believe there's an exception in there for TCAP counties. I think TCAP would still apply. But again, the bill was kind of in flux there at the end, but they did end that like 90% relief valve on these unclassified misdemeanors to say they could go to prison. But I think you're right. It's something that you need to keep an eye on.
Especially you said for TCAP, because I mean, that's us.
Yeah.
And I don't have any say in whether I'm TCAP county or not.
Anybody else have anything on SB 3? All right. The next one that I would talk about probably is the kind of flip side would be House Bill 1. That was the intervention in lieu and record sealing bill that was sponsored by Rick Plummer and based largely on comments that Chief Justice O'Connor made to the commission back in 2018, right after issue one, as far as what she saw good solutions would be. That bill would require a hearing on intervention in lieu of conviction applications that allege drug or alcohol use was a contributing factor to the offense, as well as removing caps on fourth and fifth degree felony convictions for record sealing purposes, and then raising the caps on other felony and misdemeanor offenses and shortening the length of time a lot of offenders would have to await to apply for record sealing. That bill was passed out of the House in June, went to Senate Judiciary, had six hearings, and was reported out last week on the 9th. It is awaiting a floor vote, and that is on the Senate calendar today. Without knowing too much about what's going on behind the scenes, that bill didn't move for a while out of Senate Judiciary, where Senator Eklund is the chair, as he waited to see what happened with SB 3, it seemed like, because that was his, he's the sponsor of Senate Bill 3, so he was kind of waiting to see what happened to that. So, you know, what happens with HB 1 today may depend on what happens with SB 3, but that's just me as kind of watching things and wondering what's going on. Again, it would require a House concurrence because there was a small Senate amendment that did take place. Moving forward, I think that bill would have us update the sentencing guides that we have. There's some things in there that we would update with regard to intervention in lieu of conviction. There's another record sealing bill in that was introduced based on a lot of the work. OPD worked with Rep. Rogers to create House Bill 610. Actually, I think that's 604. I'm sorry, 604. Which had a lot of the recommendations of the Rights Restoration Committee that the ad hoc committee, the commission worked on, that was included in there. So working to continue expansion of record sealing has always been one of our priorities, and that'll continue after HB 1. But if people had questions about that, we're open to those if people had any comments. All right. The next one would be Senate Bill 256. So that is juvenile extended sentence procedures. So juvenile life without parole and extended juvenile sentences of functional life sentences. That bill passed the Senate on September 23rd and then was voted out of House Criminal Justice on the 16th. That is set for a House vote today. It would need a concurrence from the Senate as it was amended a couple times in House Criminal Justice. That did stem from some work that the Juvenile Committee did put out a few years back. And it was kicked around in the last GA, these changes. Basically, the bill establishes parole eligibility dates for juveniles who were convicted of adult offenses, generally after 18 years for non-homicide offenses or 25 years for what the bill defines as aggravated homicide offenses or non-aggravated homicide offenses. It creates an exception for people who commit multiple homicides, juveniles who commit multiple homicides. There are different rules for them, whether they're eligible for special parole considerations or not. Generally, it for three or more homicides, three or more victims, where the individual is the principal offender, they have to wait until they would normally be eligible for parole. It also specifies mitigating factors for the parole board to consider, specifically with regard to these juvenile offenders. We'll continue, should that bill pass, we make that part of what we have as an upcoming. Brooke Burns, thank you for working with an intern we had on updating the juvenile sentencing guide. That's been on my calendar to get done here in the near future. This would be included in that, but we're also open to any other educational efforts or suggestions that people might have with regard to juvenile extended sentencing. All right. Senate Bill 331 is the Sunset Review Bill. That was passed out of the Senate on 12-2-20, reported out as amended in House State and Local Government yesterday, and it is scheduled for a floor vote today. It would need a concurrence due to a small amendment that was included under House consideration, and that amendment dealt specifically with the commission. It includes a couple different aspects of our modernization plan and modernization statutes. Those two things that were introduced at this time were it eliminates the need for us to have a standing juvenile committee, as well as eliminating the advisory committee. And this is part of streamlining our membership as part of the modernization. We hope it's a good start to get that modernization bill picked up in the next GA. I don't think it's that we're getting out of the juvenile business as much as wanting to work on that stuff in a more focused manner, dealing with topic specific work, as opposed to just having a general meeting where I kind of do this thing, update people on what's going on in the legislature. We talk about it for a few minutes and that's about it. So,
Scott, let me say that provision, it's paragraph D in 181.22. And it specifically outlines a group that the chief needs to appoint as a juvenile committee. So it's a committee that we haven't functionally had. We've had a juvenile committee that has focused on juvenile matters, but not in that structure. And so that's the reason for the change.
And again, that's something that is part of the modernization statutes that we're working to get in considered. There wasn't time to get it put into anything here at the end of the General Assembly, just with everything that's been going on, but we're hopeful to get that done here in the near future, and it'll include things and duties surrounding the administration of the uniform sentencing entry and the data platform. Do people have any questions on 331 or comments? The next one on here is House Bill 215. House Bill 215 was Reagan-Tokes Part 2. So that was all the changes that dealt with post-release control supervision and GPS monitoring of offenders on post-release control that didn't pass out of the 132nd General Assembly. That bill, thanks to Judge Gallagher, as always, Judge Routson, and the OJC, we worked really hard this spring to develop some fixes for Senate Bill 201 sentencing procedures and have those put into the bill, into a sub bill that was introduced back in February. After that sub bill was introduced, we went back again, had some more at another interested party meeting, looked at more changes, sort of tweaking things that were in that sub bill. And a second sub bill was introduced in House Criminal Justice a few weeks ago. That bill did not make it. It did make it out of committee on the 9th, and it is awaiting a House floor vote. It would need to go over to the Senate for consideration. It hadn't had any hearings there yet. Basically, what we'd worked for was to simplify the formula for calculating the maximum term, adding some definitions, making some changes to release options and things like that, as well as some other simple fixes for the bill that kind of clarified things for practitioners moving forward. The main focus was treating that maximum term as a tail and referring to it in as just a more simplified formula for calculating it that didn't have differences for consecutive and concurrent sentences and just said this is what it is. So moving forward, that bill, or should those changes pass, we'd be again working on educating people on the new changes and the law. One thing MARTA worked on really hard over the past couple of weeks was pulling just those amendments out of 215, because those parole changes cost money, like we've talked about before. And just because of the timing, running out of time here in lame duck, she was pretty concerned that that bill wasn't going to make it. So she did work on getting those amendments, just the fixes to Senate Bill 201 put into House Bill 431, which I'll talk about here next, which was a bill that had made it out of the House and into the Senate. Senator Eklund was open to including those changes, and we thought that those might be amended into the bill yesterday. The amendment actually didn't make it in yesterday, but it was my understanding of the last I heard was that the Senate was still considering amending that maybe at the time of the floor vote to get those changes to 201 that we really think are necessary as soon as possible into another bill. I'm happy to answer any questions people have about that if people are interested or have any questions about those changes. But right now, it's just kind of wait and see. If they don't make it into 431 today, we'll continue to pick this back up in the next General Assembly and work on things and get those changes done. But happy to answer any questions people might have about that. One other thing related to 201 that we've been working on that I wanted to bring to people's attention, and it is hosted on the commission's website. We've worked on with Judge Gallagher again and the Appellate Judges Association to develop a tracking document that has all of the pending appellate cases, all of the decided appellate cases regarding Senate Bill 201. So if you have a question about what's going on in Reagan-Tokes in your jurisdiction or another appellate district, you can look at that document, and I've got everything up until yesterday. I think there was a case decided yesterday that I haven't added yet, but you can look and see what decisions have come down regarding Reagan-Tokes, specifically dealing with the constitutionality of the indefinite sentencing scheme. We're going to keep that document updated so people are aware of what's going on. The Sixth District, there's a judge up there named Zamuda who certified a conflict between two districts to be considered by the Supreme Court. Regarding ripeness, right, Judge? Yeah, so regarding whether or not the issue was ripe for review.
Scott, the Fifth District has indicated that it's not ripe for review. They rendered a panel of three Fifth District judges sat in the Sixth on a conflict case for us, rendered the same decision. We had a subsequent case where we found that there's a split of jurisdictions, the second, the 12th, and I believe there's one other district, maybe even the third at this point, have ruled on the merits and have not indicated that it is, and therefore has indicated that it is right. So we've certified that conflict question and forwarded it on to the Supreme Court for their consideration.
I can only tell you to stay tuned.
Thank you, Chief.
Sarah and I just pasted the link to that into the chat if people want to take a look at it right now. But that is something that we have made available for people. I'm going to continue to update it. Usually it's every couple weeks, just depending on what comes down. There is in that document, there's also what pending cases we've been made aware of. Judge Gallagher has some people tracking that issue up in the 8th District. So they have a running list so that he can keep an eye on what's going on in his district. We don't have that for every district. So there at the end of the document, it does say pending appeals. So you can see kind of what we've been made aware of. And then the final end notes there are a number of cases that just cite to the sentencing statutes involved, but don't actually reference constitutionality or any other issues that are Senate Bill 201 specific. So those are in that document as well at the very end, just to let people know. This case may mention 201, but it doesn't have anything to do with it really. But we keep watching that. So we're keeping our eyes open. Similar to that effort, we have also been working on creating a resource on the Sentencing Commission's website that would allow practitioners to look and see what criminal issues have been accepted for review by the Supreme Court. The court does have an issues accepted for review page that shows you what cases they have. It's it's civil and criminal. It's everything that they've accepted for review. And while that page is useful, it's very difficult to search that for case specific topics. So what we're hoping we can create, since we're, you know, an affiliated office of the Supreme Court, but we're not the Supreme Court itself, we can create a document where we'll have all the cases that are the criminal cases that have been accepted for review, and it'll have search functionality that will allow, if Judge Salvaggio has a relatively novel criminal issue that he thinks he wants to just check, is there anything else like this pending in front of the Supreme Court? Or if he has a Senate Bill 201 sentence and wants to know, hey, what should I do on this? He'll be able to pull up this resource, search quickly for Senate Bill 201 or for Reagan-Tokes, and he'll see, oh, this certified question was accepted by the Supreme Court on this date. You know, this is right on point with what I'm looking at, or it's a different issue. So adding some functionality to an existing resource, as well as the going through and a little bit of editorializing, just in the sense that we'd be picking out issues that maybe the court itself doesn't want to say, this is a Reagan-Tokes case, or this case is that, because it might look like they're putting their finger on what they think the issue is with the case. We're in a different position where we can say, here are the issues we see as prominent in this appeal, and let people search based on that. And I'm happy to answer questions about that if people have. We're continuing to work with the court on that to see how we can develop that sort of a web-based resource as opposed to just a document that lets people search more readily. All right, the next bill on my list is House Bill 431. House Bill 431 dealt with what they call the sexual exploitation database. It was going to establish basically a database of offenders convicted of soliciting, like Johns, who had been arrested for soliciting prostitutes. That bill's been whittled down. It was whittled down from this, you know, AG-operated database of everyone convicted of soliciting prostitution. Then it was whittled down to a pilot program. And then most recently, that bill was amended to even take the pilot program out. But what it had done, had been a number of bills had been amended into 431. It was turning into what is colloquially referred to as the Christmas tree bill. It does have Senate Bill 13. Senate Bill 13, which was changes to the human trafficking provisions for juvenile victims or juvenile offenders. So juveniles who were the victims of human trafficking, it was a bill that had been passed by the Senate and hadn't moved for a while. That was incorporated into 431. That's still in there. Changes around that were included in Senate Bill 47 was a bill about unlawful sexual conduct with a minor offenders being able to petition for reclassification under certain circumstances and get their records sealed. That was amended into the bill, and that still remains in there. And then there's Senate Bill 247 was amended in, which creates it removes some soliciting offenses and creates two new ones, basically distinguishing between buyers and sellers on the solicitation. So there's a solicitation charge for buyers and a solicitation charge for sellers, as well as a new offense of knowingly soliciting another to engage in sexual activity for hire and engaging in prostitution and receiving proceeds of prostitution. So a couple of changes around there. Moving forward, we were working with the Judicial College and Judge Routson, as well as Judge Chris Cook, on a major sex offender sentencing guide that we'll put out hopefully in the early part of next year. And we'll continue to use that information, those resources, in conjunction with the sentencing entry. But happy to answer any questions about 431 if people have any or comments. All right, talked about House Bill 1. House Bill 136 dealt with imposing the death penalty on people suffering from a mental illness. That bill passed out of the House in June and then passed out of the Senate last week. It would need House concurrence at some point. It prohibited the death penalty for people suffering from a serious mental illness as defined by the bill at the time of the offense. And those offenses were schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, and delusional disorder. And it establishes procedures for people who are already convicted to appeal. So that bill is just waiting for a House concurrence and Senate amendments. And that's kind of everything I had listed for what we think's moving out of or has been moving recently. There are some other bills I wanted to talk about, but if people had any other things they think might move today they wanted to discuss, feel free to weigh in. A couple other things were Senate Bill 353 was a bill that was introduced shortly before our last meeting on bail and pretrial reform. It was introduced on August 19th. It had a second hearing in Senate Judiciary on November 10th. That's a bill based upon the Supreme Court's task force to examine the Ohio bail system, as well as the Commission's ad hoc committee on bail and pretrial services. That bill was introduced with the expectation, I think, that it's going to get picked up in the next General Assembly. So we'll remain engaged on bail and pretrial services moving forward and look for that bill to get started up in the next General Assembly. It contained a lot of the same data collection provisions that were in previous versions of the bill. And, you know, we continue to work on what we can do to help with that. Senate Bill 156, prohibiting and defrauding drug alcohol tests. That bill was, this dealt with synthetic urine used to defraud a drug test. It passed out of the Senate on February 12th and then was reported out of the House committee yesterday. So we'll see if that gets a floor vote as well. Creates a new offense for creating, selling synthetic urine for the purposes of defrauding a drug test. It's an F3 when it's used to defraud a drug test that's imposed as part of community control. And it also specifically says it doesn't preclude prosecution for tampering with evidence, which was in my days in practice is what we usually do with somebody like that. Charging with an F3 tampering or obstruction of official business. So the bill would allow for this additional charge. This is an additional charge and not to the exclusion of either of those offenses. That bill is, we'll have to wait and see if that bill makes it out. Senate Bill 369 deals with the AG's Crime Victims Compensation Fund. That bill passed out of the Senate on November 18th. And then was voted out of House Criminal Justice yesterday and is awaiting a floor vote. It loosens restrictions on compensation available to victims of crime through that Attorney General program. Shortens the look back period for criminal convictions that might exclude somebody from compensation and expanding the individuals who can apply, who are defined for those purposes as victims, whether that's a family member or something like that. Self-defense duty to retreat bills. So stand your ground bills there were four bills actually. The two that were moving most recently were Senate Bill 383 and House Bill 796. Originally they had two bills introduced, 381, House Bill 381 and Senate Bill 237, which were stand your ground bills, but also contained this sort of pretrial immunity hearing process that was kind of a second trial that they wanted to create for somebody who claimed self-defense. Where that the issues of stand your ground could be or duty to retreat could be litigated before you started the trial. Those bills hadn't moved. So just bills that strictly removed the duty to retreat consideration had been moving. House Bill 796 had its vote status pulled at the last minute yesterday. Senate Bill 383 was reported out of a Senate committee on the 9th. So last week. That bill could be amended into another bill during whatever happens today. So we'll continue to monitor that. House Bill 3 dealt with domestic violence and emergency protection orders, was passed out of the House. This was Aisha's law based on the homicide that occurred up there in Cuyahoga County, passed out of the House in May. It accepted a substitute bill at a second hearing in Senate Judiciary on 12-2, and then it didn't have another hearing after that. So that one might be one that gets picked up in the next General Assembly as well. House Bill 263 dealt with occupational licensing. Part of the record sealing things that bill has a hearing scheduled for this morning. It was supposed to have a hearing yesterday. Revises licensing procedures to help people with prior convictions get an occupational license, requiring specific disqualifying convictions and prohibiting disqualifications from licenses based on a standard like moral turpitude. They're trying to really drill down on making sure that people who have convictions can get licenses more readily for different employment that requires a license. Senate Bill 377 and House Bill 403 dealt with the transitional control judicial veto. Those bills had a number of hearings. House Bill 403 got introduced back in November of last year and had a second hearing in House Criminal Justice last week. Senate Bill 377 was introduced on the 9th of this year and had a second hearing in Senate Judiciary last week as well. Efforts to remove the judicial veto over transitional control continue. Neither of those bills made it out of committee. So could they end up in something here today? Possibly. But it seemed like they hadn't moved since last week. I talked a little bit about House Bill 604, which was Rep. Rogers' record sealing reform bill. That bill had a substitute bill at a first hearing in House Criminal Justice on the 3rd of this month. I think that's one that you might look to see get picked up in the next General Assembly. And then finally, House Bill 610 was the Marcy's Law bill that Speaker Cupp introduced. It was introduced in April of this year, had a third hearing in House Criminal Justice in November on the 19th. It was the statutory enactment of the Marcy's Law Amendment to the Ohio Constitution. That's another bill that's going to get picked up in the next General Assembly. We were involved in a number of IP meetings on the bill. I know the appellate judges through the OJC are working on refining the appeal provisions that are currently in the bill for victims who believe their rights have been violated, working to refine what's currently in the bill, allowing how that appeal process might work. So again, we'll continue to monitor impact and discuss that with you guys as that moves forward. That's basically everything I had that was moving, unless people have questions or other questions about other bills or specific provisions with any of those bills I talked about. That's what I got, Sarah. Back to you.
All right.
Sarah, within Scott's presentation, I thought I had heard him say comments for next year. And so I don't know if this would be the time to bring it up.
Yes, please.
But I do have two thoughts or comments or goals that I think the commission should have for next year. And one of them feeds off of some of Scott's comments with regard to the practitioner tools that the commission is developing. You know, over the last 18 months or so, commission staff have done an excellent job at putting together guides and charts and things for practitioners to use. Unfortunately, those items are buried in our website. And one of the things I'd like to see the commission move toward is marketing itself as an agency that provides practitioner tools. Now, you know, I'm thankful that we have a presence on the Supreme Court website and maybe with regard to our icon on that website, you know, we could redesign it where it says practitioner tools and then, you know, in smaller print put Criminal Sentencing Commission and then, you know, then it leads us to our website or whatever. But I think as a commission, you know, we struggle sometimes with members and audience members questioning our relevancy. And we are doing things as a commission where we need to, I mean, we're providing outstanding work, but it's just not getting into the hands of those who could really benefit from it. And whether we need to perhaps encourage judges on their own website to put a practitioner tool tab that all gets redirected to the Sentencing Commission or the Criminal Justice Commission or whatever we're going to be next year. But I would really advocate that somehow we get the message out about the tools that are that we have. Secondly, and I don't know that this is a call to service, but there was a case that just came out of the 4th District on December 8th, State versus Penwell, and it's a 2020 Ohio 6727. It was a criminal sentencing case that got reversed by the appellate court. But what caught my eye was paragraph 13, which said as follows, we also again extend our sympathy to trial courts for their unenviable daily task of attempting to navigate Ohio's convoluted web of felony sentencing statutes and issues. Prior to 1996, Ohio felony sentences involved simple, straightforward statutes that the bench, bar, and most importantly, the general public could easily understand. Since that time, Ohio's complex sentencing scheme does not promote judicial economy and diminishes the general public's understanding of this very important aspect of the criminal justice system. All laws should be clear, precise, and uniform. Unfortunately, Ohio's felony sentence statutes fall short of that important goal. And so what I would advocate is that this commission make as a priority, once again, to simplify Ohio's sentencing statutes. And we've talked about, and that case again is State versus Penwell, 2020, Ohio 6727. The case itself, I got some questions about why there was an appeal, but that aside, you know, we have opportunities in the OVI law and Reagan Tokes again. I mean, we really make it hard on ourselves. And I'm not looking to take business away from Zamuda and Gallagher, but it seems like a lot of what we do is self-inflicted as a system. And so I would like to see us commit as a commission to identify certain areas of our sentencing statutes that need attention and that we appoint, whether they be single subject specific task forces or whatever, to get those things in front of legislators that we can get it passed. And I'm not just talking about adult sentencing, juvenile sentencing, and I'm not speaking for juvenile judges, but my goodness, I think we should start with the 1991 Criminal Justice Handbook and maybe add from that as opposed to what we've got today. So in any event, those are two priorities I'd like to see the commission do. Number one, get the practitioner tools that we are developing with outstanding work staff, get them in the hands of those who could really use it. And number two, let's work on specific sentencing statutory reform.
Does anybody object? I mean, I think we are with you on that, Judge Savaggio. We've talked about trying to do a better job of sharing information and making it easier to find those resources on our website. So thank you for acknowledging that indeed that's an important thing for us to do. And I know Judge Banigal and I spoke last night, and he's interested in trying to move us along too on streamlining and making things much more administratively easy to go through the code. We've talked about it in a number of groups. You've all served on a number of those groups. I know the governor's PRC task or work group continues to talk about how that group can assist in the effort. So I'd be happy to begin work on how to frame that. And I'd appreciate it if some of our members would volunteer to support that effort. I mean, if we can start with a small group that kind of gets together to talk it through and maybe outline how best to achieve it, I think that would be the best way to move forward. And I'd be happy to hear from the other members on the webinar today, because you all are so quiet. And when we're in person, you talk a lot. So speak up, please.
as an aside, there is in MARTA, in a judicial conference yesterday with community corrections, made reference to a proposed bill or maybe a bill in draft form that is looking at, Gene, what's the fancy word where you take a bunch of stuff and you bring it under one umbrella? Whatever it is, the with Ohio's release mechanisms from the prison. So
it's omnibus, Judge Salaggio.
Marta, you saved me. Thank you.
No problem.
I didn't even realize you were on, but it should tell you I pay attention to what you say. But in any event, bringing all of that, can you maybe speak a little bit about it so these guys don't have to listen to me?
Okay, I just remuted myself. So I think you might be talking about two Community Corrections Committee meetings ago when I talked about a criminal justice omnibus that Representative Seitz is looking at. Does that sound familiar?
It's where you mentioned it yesterday, where we're taking all the release mechanisms from the prison system and trying to put it under kind of.
Oh, right. Okay. So that's an ODRC effort that comes out of recommendations. And I don't remember the exact recommendations, but this was, you know, the Council of State Governments or the Justice Reinvestment Project. One of those groups had recommendations about the various early release mechanisms and the fact that some of them aren't used because, you know, they're too complicated to use. Some of them aren't used because they're just not popular. And it would be much better to have a simpler, easy way to understand how early release is supposed to work, you know, how someone applies. If someone applies and they're eligible for early release, that there doesn't have to be any kind of, you know, calculation of, you know, 80% or whatever. So just a much simplified, streamlined look at early release mechanisms. And that's something that DRC is going to try to work on in the next GA based on these recommendations from, I'm going to say the Council of State Government.
It was JRI 2.0, Marta.
Okay.
So yeah, CSG, but yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously there's, you know, between OVI, PRC, what Marta just talked about, you know, there's plenty of room for us to kind of look at the code and pick out and prioritize and do some things. So as far as goals, you know, I think that would be helpful. So maybe, Sarah, we can put together a group to develop those ideas, prioritize, and then start assigning.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
All right. What you got next?
Well, it was a great segue into the next segment of kind of looking ahead. What's, you know, and both Judge Zamuda and Scott talked about kind of year-end wrap-up and what we're looking at as we move into the next year. So you'll see our work continue on the uniform sentencing entry, the data platform, the resources that we try to make available, and the move to the Criminal Justice Commission. But I wanted to give some time on the agenda for member updates, because in this kind of environment, it you know, we don't have that kind of interaction to talk about our different perspectives. And so we build in some time for member updates and conversation among the group. And I'm sure there's someone that is willing to volunteer to go first or has something to look forward to, or what we should, as you pointed out, Judge Salvaggio, maybe what the commission should focus on in the upcoming year. So I'd like to hear from our members. I could call on the ones I see on my screen. You know, we have like multiple screens, but because it's nice to see your faces. But does anybody have anything in addition to what Judge Salvaggio has charged us with to look forward, looking ahead to for next year? I mean, that's a lot.
Sarah, I'd like to really follow up with about what Judge Nick said, because I really think it's important we're seeing an awful lot of appeals filed related to sentencing where there's really a lack of clarity in the statutes about, you know, not only at the trial court level, but at the review level. We can all point to that State v. Gwynn case that the Supreme Court heard and now is back in the Fifth District. And who knows what's going to happen with that. And I just think there's a lack of clarity in many of those statutes. You know, Senate Bill 2, 295308, was written nearly 25 years ago. And while there have been little tweaks here and there, they've never really addressed things like contrary to law and concepts like that, that, you know, I feel bad for the Supreme Court when they have to decide these things because there really is no clarity to this. They almost have to legislate from the bench. And that's the worst form of all. And I think we owe it to our fellow judges to really demand of the legislature that they give us some clarity on this. I know Marta and Josh work tirelessly on this and try to bring it to them. And it just doesn't seem to be a priority. And we're wasting millions of taxpayer dollars driving inmates back and forth, you know, to from institutions to resentencings for pointless purposes that we ought to be able to provide clarity. And then I think about the victims. And I was a former prosecutor, and I can't imagine what it must be like to have to call up a rape victim 2-3 years after they're trying to get on with their life. And they're told, oh, by the way, remember how that guy got, 11 to 16 and a half? Well, guess what? That's been reversed. And under Marcy's law, you have to come back in now. We're going to do this all over again. It's just not fair to the public, either economically, socially, to victims, to anybody else. We need to demand clarity from the legislature on what exactly the sentencing process is and how it works, and stop this nonsense of driving inmates back and forth. It's not fair to the inmate. He gets pulled out of the institution, or she gets pulled out of the institution too, loses their bed space, everything else. So I just think, Nick, I can't thank you enough for saying it. And I really think it's time for us as judges to put our foot down on this. So I'll shut up there.
All right. Thank you, Judge Gallagher. Anyone else? Kyle, is there someone, are you working on the package for DRC, or is there, can you enlighten us a little or get back to us on what the plan is, or if there is a plan? Okay. Yeah. I mean, I see the name, but maybe he's not with us. So we'll follow up with DRC to see what they and Marta have talked about. And if you're interested in working with us to identify other topics, please contact me and we'll get a small group together to put together an outline and move forward. I mean, we have lots of work that's already been done. We need to consider, of course, what RECOD did and the justice reinvestment folks. It's not like we have to start brand new. So I think we just make a concerted effort to move some items forward. Are there
Sarah, I have a comment. Should we be looking at, as much as I hate to say this, this appears to be our new normal as far as how we handle our court business by Zoom and teleconferencing and those type of things. And it doesn't surprise me that the appeals have skyrocketed because of things that may have occurred in the criminal process for some of these individuals where they feel their due process rights have been compromised or not afforded them and so on. And maybe the commission needs to be looking at something along the lines of legislation, working with the legislature and adapting this new normal to certain standards so that we don't have to worry about violating or crossing over those due process rights and so on. So, I like to think that someday we'll go back to the way it was, but I want to be realistic and figure that if this is the way it's going to be from here on out, we better be prepared to adjust the way we approach our judicial system from every aspect, and this is certainly an important one.
Okay, thank you, Judge Fregali. And Judge Savaggio, I don't know if you can speak to it, but I think there are some pending court rule changes for remote
I don't know. I know that I think we went, I think it was Criminal Rule 11 and Criminal Rule 41 are in the process of being approved or have been submitted for public comment with regard to search warrants and some other things. But it's Criminal Rule 43 that I think causes a lot of judges some real concern.
Okay. I heard you mention that earlier this week. So I know we're out of the rule making.
Talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was an OJC criminal practice a meeting earlier this week that I participated in. And Judge Huffman gave us an update on some of the rule changes. And I had made the suggestion that Criminal Rule 43, at least on the adult side, be looked at. And the concern for the judges is that I think all of us want to do as many things as we can by Zoom. The problem is that, number one, under Criminal Rule 43, at least on the adult side, you have to get the defendant's waiver, at least as I interpret the rule. And then what a lot of people may overlook is that I think it's Article 1, Section 8 of the Ohio Constitution also require the the criminal presence of the defendant. Now, for me, anytime an attorney comes to me and says, or calls my staff and says, hey, my client's got symptoms or I've got symptoms, you know, what do you want us to do? And we'll, the first thing we say is, well, let's do it by video. You know, if it's, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. And assuming we can get the technology together, then I have a little cheat sheet to make sure that the defendant understands he's got a constitutional right to appear and a constitutional right to have his attorney present, and, you know, he, and a procedural right to appear. And, you know, are you willing to waive that? And if you're willing to waive that, and I can explain to you how to administer Criminal Rule 43, then you know, we go ahead and move it forward. The problem is, I think that judges can't unilaterally just say, well, we're going to do this by Zoom conference. Okay. So for the judges that are just saying, well, we're going to unilaterally have this and don't get the waiver, I think that's really where we have the problem.
Okay, thank you. And the other thing that occurs to me, Judge Rigali, is...
Sarah, we're losing you.
With Judge Koss, because I know we're tasked, because he's chairing... Am I back?
You're back now.
So there's an iCourt task force. Okay, there's an iCourt task force that Judge Koss chairs. And so I'll check with him to see if they're kind of running down this road as well. And I'll get back to everyone about that. Or maybe we can ask them to present or give us some information for our next meeting. Anything else for the good of the order or member updates? I do know we had a couple members that were reappointed. Gwen, welcome back. Not that you left, but, and Chief Chandler was also reappointed by the governor. I don't think that she joined us, but Judge Jameson, who has been representing the juvenile judges group, won election to the Court of Appeals. And so she begins that role next year, I think next summer. So we'll be looking for another juvenile judge appointment. So we're moving along here.
Sarah, do we have the new appointments for the House and the Senate?
No, as you all probably remember, all of our legislative appointments expire December 31st of this year. So we'll be looking for new appointments from both the House and the Senate in the new General Assembly. And that usually happens sometime in February and March, hopefully before our first meeting.
Chief?
Thanks, Judge. Out of a recent case we had in Logan County, Bell Fountain, my agency investigated it. We had a runaway 13-year-old that made us highlight this problem. We found what I believe is a serious concern I have in the lack of wording in the law. This runaway had hooked up with a 32-year-old man out of state in an online chat room. He agreed, they made a plan. So this is all without parental consent or knowledge. He travels from Virginia. He transports this girl. She doesn't know where he's taking her. They end up back in Virginia. I've had to send my investigators to Virginia. We found him. We worked with Virginian authorities there. But the fascinating part about this case is that there was no admissions of any sexual assault of any kind or that. So the only thing that we could find fell back to interference with custody, which is, in my mind, we have a 32-year-old grown man traveling from another state. This is extremely serious. And so we fell short, we felt, with discussions with our prosecutor to charge him with abduction, because there was no statements that any sex had actually occurred. And so coincidentally, as our investigators were in Virginia, they built their own case and have now since arrested him and charged him with abduction. He has since confessed to that this is not his first time, of course. And so now we're desperately trying to find his other victim. So we're going to be looking at this further in the legislature to change some words, add some words, whatever the case is. But this is just one of many that bothers me with how either a lack of or maybe just not the right approach. Online crimes have just skyrocketed. And my concern is that if you throw this into the grouping of how technology has impacted our youth, how technology has impacted all of us, but especially on telemarketers and the threats that the elderly get on phone calls. I mean, this ranges from anything from possible abduction cases to just telephone harassment. But where are we going to draw the line for how many times a company gets to call somebody, as an example, on the polar opposite of the scales? 1 minute we're talking about a child being abducted. The other minute we're talking about, it's still media, it's still electronics, it's still everything that's associated with it. So as we move forward, I've asked the Ohio Association of Chiefs of Police Legislative Committee to look at the online child predator type laws, but also interference with custody, abduction. Why do we have to wait for a child to be molested by a predator to make this a felony? I was shocked, and unfortunately, it appears that this could be a loophole, that this person, if he lived in Ohio even, and maybe drove from another city or community under the same premise, doesn't matter if he's out of state or in state, we're left with a misdemeanor. And to me, that's astonishing. So we are going to be pursuing this, hopefully, in this next year early, put this in front of someone quickly, because if it is a loophole, this should scare all of us that our children are at risk, and we shouldn't have to wait for the victim of a crime to admit that this happened to them. And so just wanted to bring it to your attention. It is serious, but we're seeing these online and group type things where it's all electronic media, no matter how you slice it, whether it's by the phones or computers. This is the new wave that we're going to face, and we're all facing it now. It's just in different varieties. So I wanted to bring it in front of the group.
All right. Thank you, Chief. Anyone else?
Sarah?
Yes.
This is Laura.
Hi.
I had two things to say. One in regards to what the Chief just spoke about. This was, I can't remember exactly how many years ago it was now, but there was an issue before the 10th District Court of Appeals relating to the criminal child enticement provisions. And there are some decisions out there that are challenging relating to how to get the behavior involving making children come with you when you are not their guardian. So I support what the chief is trying to accomplish and would put out there that there are some challenges there. But second, related to his underlying comment about social media, can I just put a pitch out there once more for misdemeanor investigative subpoenas? Because what we're seeing still at the misdemeanor level from the prosecutor divisions is the inability to obtain evidence that's necessary when individuals come and complain that social media is being used to commit a variety of crimes. And we're in the position where because the current investigative subpoena provision under the Ohio Revised Code is limited to felony level offenses, we essentially have to tell those individuals that there's nothing we can do to help them. I've tried to work that through the legislature for, I think it's been 15 years now with three different attempts. But I would just put out there that part of the concern about enforcing those crimes that are committed using social media is lack of an investigative tool for those offenses that are still misdemeanors.
Judge, if I could add to your remarks, what I have done this year actually is we've run into the same problem trying to get Facebook and other social media sites to cooperate for subpoenas at times. Sometimes they're really good, others they are not. And so I have alerted members of Congress about this because to me, it's going to have to start on a federal level to get the full cooperation. I don't know where all that ends up, but made that my voice heard in D.C. about it.
Sarah?
Yes, Judge Spanagel.
I hate to say an online element of a felony, and I can see Tim Young probably cringing if we're talking about I'm stuck in jail, but taking the chief's issue, and I've seen one or two in our court where somebody's gone to Nebraska, whether or not an element escalatable to felony level based upon, let's just take teenage kids, based upon the solicitation if done online, that might felony escalate separate from me just meeting a teenager at the mall. And I just throw it out there for discussion. I don't know if you'd want a blanket online element for escalation, but certainly involving children, it may be worth considering. End of comment.
All right, thank you. I think that pretty much wraps us up, Judge Savaggio, unless there's comments from anyone else. Our next meeting will be by Zoom, March 18th.
All right. Well, if there's nothing else, then for the good of the order, can I have a motion to adjourn?
Ellie, so moved.
All right. Beth, thank you very much. We're done. Have a nice winter season.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Happy holidays.
Very well.
Bye. See you next year.